It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Broadcasting live today, but not video streaming because I'm on location. And we're just completing some very important filming for an important feature documentary which will air later in this season. Today we're going to talk about health and healing. From a major research center in China, how regular green tea loosens your arteries to lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. Then from Drexel College, at any skill level, even if you're just a novice doing it for the first time, making art reduces stress hormones. And from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, trees that give you nuts, walnuts, pine nuts, are so rich in their nutrients, but of course it matters what you fertilize the soil with, and if you're doing it right, you're fertilizing them at least every 3 months. And by the way, most farmers are not aware of this. It's amazing when I travel around America and stop and speak with farmers. I'll see an orchard. In fact, if you go upstate New York, right outside of New Paltz, and going from there over about 20 miles and north, you'll see dozens of apple orchards. And you ask them, how often do you fertilize? And they're using synthetic fertilizers, which are not good. But if they were to use natural fertilizers, they should do it every 3 months. So if you have fruit trees, every 3 months. If you have shrubs, every 3 months. A lot of people listening live in tropical climates, in the United States and out of the United States. But if you live in Florida, for example, where we have a lot of palm trees, then every 3 months you should put palm fertilizer down. When you start seeing the leaves turn brown, well, if not, that's a manganese deficiency. Anyhow, once you get the right nutrients, you're going to get those nutrients going into the tree. The tree then takes it up and gets it into the fruit. The fruit then gets pollinated with bees, and then you end up with nuts. And those are good for cancer, prostate, and heart conditions. More on that, plus more on health and healing. Then we're going to take a look at an original report today, compiled by myself and Jeremy, one of our scholars in residence. It is posted on our website, 7 Reasons to Never Use Smart Meters. In fact, when I had come off the road and taken a trip home, I live in New York City, but I also live in Florida, I saw a person reading the meter, which is fine because it's almost always zero because my whole house is completely 100% solar powered. So it's all clean, and there's no cost for that. And I have my own water wells, clean water, so it's a very small bill. But I was curious about the reading because the guy had mentioned something. I took a look and I said, that's a smart meter. I don't want a smart meter on my home. So I told him to take it out. He's, well, he couldn't do it. I said, well, you can do it. And indeed he did. But I had to write a letter. I'll tell you how to get rid of the smart meters and why you don't want them. From Paris, France, we'll have Barry Lando talking about the whole area that is not discussed at all of artificial intelligence and what it means. Now, a lot of people say, that's really good. We're into that. What if that artificial intelligence was to take your job? How would you feel about that? So we're going to look at artificial intelligence and see where they're making it possible, where these robotics are working. Let's get to as much as we can. We're going to start by taking a look at walnuts and almonds. Now, I've shared several pieces this week about why nuts are good for your health. This is just adding to that. This is from Harvard Medical School, published in the British Journal of Cancer. This is a large study, 47,000 men, mainly physicians. And what they found is those doctors and men who had the highest nut consumption had the greatest protection from prostate cancer risk and death. And that's very big. All right, and we're talking about almonds, Brazil nuts, cashews, hazelnuts, macadamias, pecans, pine nuts, pistachios, and walnuts. And by the way, a peanut is not a nut, it's a legume. But that gives you the types that we should have. Now, how often should we have it? 5 days a week. And how much? Not a lot. You know, around 3 ounces. So that's a small amount. Quote, "This is important," said the lead researcher, MD, and doctor of science in the Department of Medicine. Since more men live with prostate cancer than die from it, and talking about how this could lower your risk. So men, let's start having nut butters, organic nut butters, and raw is the best, and have that each day. Throw it in your smoothie, too. This is from Drexel College. And by the way, it was from Drexel University that a doctor, Carew, as well as Tom Graff, came to me and suggested using some really state-of-the-art equipment to measure the value, the energy value of different foods at that time at the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was a research fellow. And we did. Over a two-year period, a Dr. Dean, Douglas Dean, and Dr. Graff, myself, because they had heard I was doing it, and this was just a more advanced way of measuring it. And on a scale of, let's say, 0 to 10, we were able to show that anything that registered 8, 9, or 10, you could classify as healing. And from 5 to 7, 5, 6, and 7, those were classified as sustainable, meaning that you could sustain your life if you had those. And below 5, down to 0, if you had that predominantly in your diet, meaning making up the most of your diet, you would be more susceptible to disease and illness. And then we started looking at hospital food, and it was generally between 0 and 3. And the average fast food meal was about 3. So then when I started implementing through the Trafalgar Hospital's nutrition department a diet that was exclusively 8, 9, and 10, we began to see some very positive improvements in people's conditions, including the reversal, complete reversal, of an end-stage cancer in a woman who happened to have been my editor at a very big publishing company and had edited some of my best-selling books. And I didn't know she had not told anyone that she was there, and she was in hospice care, and 6 months later, she has no cancer. And again, I attribute the majority of that to the energy from the food. So keep in mind, the more processed a food is, any food, the less vitalism it has. Now, that may sound a little esoteric or existential, but it's very real. Because what do you do in life? Everything is a matter of sharing an energy. You bring an energy in, and you share an energy out. And it is the sharing of the high vibrational energies, harmonizing them, that we feel the most excited. That's called love, a love experience. And it stimulates our love hormones, and it stimulates our biochemistry, and our stress levels come down, and our DNA is turned on. And yet, science can't measure this. So they don't believe it exists. But every single mother that's ever loved and sang her lullaby to her child understands this. Everyone that's ever looked in someone else's eyes and you just lose yourself in that moment, you understand that. The intuitive ability to harmonize with someone so you even know what they're going to say before they do, When someone's not in the right state of mind, you'll say, what's wrong? They didn't have to do anything or say anything. You knew something was wrong. And you know it. Well, science doesn't believe any of this because it hasn't proven it yet. And here's the short answer to all those arrogant, conceited, self-righteous, and really limited doctors and scientists and educators in America. Reality always supersedes scientific validation. In any case, I found that giving people high energy vibrational foods enhance well-being. Now, what have we found out since then? That was 30 years ago. Absolutely correct. That's why you got to give yourself the healthy diet. Now, from Drexel, and this just stuck in my mind because this is from Drexel College, they have a study that shows, this is their College of Nursing and Health Professionals, kind of ironic because I'll bet if you contacted every nursing school in America and asked them, do you offer a course in therapeutic touch? They would say yes. Well, who founded therapeutic touch? A professor of nursing, head of nursing at New York University. And that was Dr. Dolores Krieger. And what was the basis of therapeutic touch's validation? Oh, a study done at the Institute of Applied Biology, photographs of which you can see on my website. And that was a Gary Noll study. It's called the Energy Study. Long time ago, that verified the fact that some, not all, human beings are able to harness and act as vehicles to share an energy that can actually impact the outcome of animals. In this case, it was rats with terminal cancer. They, out of 50 people, five of them reversed it. One of them was Dolores Krieger, and you can see her there with her mouse meditating. And that was the scientific validation of therapeutic touch. Interesting when you go back to a place and find out where it came from. That's energy that they use now. Anyhow, they found at Drexel that if you're interested in art on any level, and you begin to engage in art with any type of art, you, quote, reduce cortisol levels, and that makes a big difference of reducing stress. The so-called biomarkers are biological indicators like hormones that can be used to measure conditions in the body, like stress. And cortisol, C-O-R-T-I-S-O-L, cortisol, was one such hormone measured in the study through saliva samples. And the higher a person's cortisol level, the more stressed a person's likely to be. And they found that when you're learning about art, when you're working with clay or just drawing on paper, whatever type of work you're doing, sculpting, it doesn't matter. It's acting as a therapy. So art in any form reduces stress. And hence, you should try to bring some art into your life where you're activated in it, you're doing something, and it can help relieve stress, and that can help you heal. From Harvard School of Public Health, skip the meat, skip the type 2 diabetes. Quote, eating a mainly plant-based diet, especially one with lots of healthy vegetables, fruits, and whole grains, may significantly lower your risk of type 2 diabetes. This study highlights that even moderate dietary changes in the direction of a healthy plant-based diet can play a significant role in the prevention of type 2 diabetes, end quote. Quote, these findings further provide evidence to support current dietary recommendations for chronic disease prevention. Well, that's pretty good. Was it a big study? Yeah. 200,000 Americans. A long study? 20 years. So your grains, whole grains, your fruits, your vegetables, your nuts, your legumes, that is what prevents diabetes. And also regular tea consumption loosens your arteries. New research has shown that regular, let's say green tea consumption can protect against arterial stiffness in the heart, a condition that's been linked to shortened lifespan and higher risk of cardiovascular disease. And the study looked at both regular tea drinkers and non-tea drinkers, and they found that if you've been drinking tea regularly for 6 years or more, you have the lowest levels of arterial wall thickening and loss of elasticity, and that means your heart is healthier, and that means you're less likely to suffer. So that's good news. So drink your organic green tea. And remember, they're rich in flavonoids also, and that relaxes your blood vessel, and that allows the blood flow smoother. This was published in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition. And finally, a study supports cranberries and probiotics in the antibacterial effects in the uterus and in the urethra. This is the University of Wisconsin, published in the Journal of Functional Foods. Quote, a combination of proanthocyanidins derived from cranberries with select probiotic strains may reduce the invasiveness of E. coli and help protect against urinary tract infections. Now, we absolutely knew from hundreds of studies and peer-reviewed literature that cranberries, cranberry juice unsweetened, cranberry concentrate best of all, really impact your beneficial acidity in the body, and that can help prevent bacteria like E. coli from adhering to cells inside your urethra or your bladder. But what we didn't know was by adding in probiotics, the good bacteria, it enhanced it, made it even better. So, quote, this observation is primarily attributed to the presence of adhesive organelles on the surface of the E. coli, but not on the surface of the L. acidophilus, which means when you have the good bacteria, the bad E. coli cannot adhere and stay there. They're washed away. And by the way, if you take in vitamin C at the same time, it's even better. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're going to take a brief break and come back and share 7 reasons to never use a smart meter. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now for a special report. And this special report is reproduced, the whole article, up on my website. So please read it. It is fully referenced, and it can help you. It is entitled 7 Reasons to Never Use Smart Meters. In 2009, President Obama announced a $3.4 billion plan for the federal government to invest in a smart grid energy system. The investment plan, touted as a big step towards energy efficiency, aimed to provide homeowners with up-to-hour data on their consumption of electricity and other utilities using devices known as smart meters. Now, it was argued that by enabling customers to monitor their energy use in this way, they would be motivated to use less energy and lower their utility bills. In the years since, energy companies have replaced millions of traditional analog utility meters with smart meters. Now, as of today, over 60 5 million smart meters are being used across the United States. The vast majority of these devices are installed in homes, residential settings. Today it's becoming quite evident that the smart grid system has failed to live up to its expectations. As reported in a recent Washington Post article, the emergence of the technology has done virtually nothing to reduce electricity use in the United States. Even still, many states are requiring that residents use smart meters, and it's often the case that homeowners have them installed without being told about it. The advent of smart meters has sparked controversy around topics like privacy rights and cyber terrorism. And perhaps worst of all, smart meters may be very harmful to human health. Here's why. One, smart meters may cause cancer. The radio frequency waves emitted by smart meters and other wireless devices have been identified as carcinogenic in numerous studies. A new study conducted by the U.S. government's National Toxicological Program found higher rates of brain and heart malignancies among rats exposed to cell phone radio frequency waves. Dr. Otis Brawley, chief medical officer for the American Cancer Society, remarked in an interview that the NTP report linking radio frequency radiation to two types of cancer marks a paradigm shift in our understanding of radiation and cancer risk. In addition, the World Health Organization categorizes radio frequency waves as a group 2B, meaning potential carcinogen. And materials including DDT, lead, and engine exhaust are also in group 2B. Number two, smart meters may cause numerous health issues. And this is what the media has not shared with you. This is what no one has talked about. Even though the potential health effects of smart meters have been well studied, a few surveys and an expanding body of anecdotal evidence have revealed that smart meters may adversely affect human health. Dr. Ronald M. Powell compiled a list of health conditions which smart meter users surveyed believe may have been linked to exposure to non-ionizing radiation emitted by the smart meters. Here are the list. Sleep problems, including insomnia, difficult falling asleep, night walking, nightmares, stress, agitation, anxiety, irritability, headaches, sharp pain or pressure in the head, ringing in the ears, ear pain, high-pitched ringing, concentration, memory and learning problems, fatigue, muscle and physical weakness, disorientation, dizziness or balance problems, eye problems, including eye pain and pressure in the eyes, cardiac symptoms, heart palpitations, heart arrhythmias, and chest pain, leg cramps or neuropathy, arthritis, body pain, sharp and stabbing pains, nausea, flu-like symptoms, sinus problems and nosebleeds, respiratory problems, cough and asthma, skin rashes and facial flushing, urinary problems, endocrine disorders including thyroid problems and diabetes, high blood pressure, changes in menstrual cycle, hyperactivity or changes in children's behavior, seizures, and reoccurrence of cancers. Number three, smart meters are a fire hazard. Reports from around the world show that smart meters are prone to catch fire and even explode. In the span of 2 years, the towns of Reno and Sparks, Nevada had 9 fires linked to smart meters, prompting the local fire chiefs to call for a probe of the safety of this wireless technology. In 2015, thousands of residents in Stockton, California were rocked by the simultaneous explosion of dozens of smart meters caused by a power surge. Number four, smart meters leave us vulnerable to cyber attacks. Using smart meters opens up the energy grid to potential catastrophic cyber attacks. For this reason, former CIA Director James Woosley declared the installation of smart grid to be, quote, really, really stupid. Five, smart meters pose a threat to privacy. Privacy rights advocates have expressed concerns over the invasive nature of smart meters. Here's what the electric company and your government agencies and your legislators did not tell you. A smart meter makes you susceptible to identity theft. They can determine personal behavior patterns. They can determine specific appliances used. They can perform real-time surveillance. They can reveal activities through your entire residential data. They can target home invasions, such as latch key for the elderly. They can provide accidental invasions. They can engage in activity censorship. Those controlling the smart meters could turn on or off, block any single electrical appliance in your home, including your computers. The decisions and actions are based upon inaccurate data. They can profile you. Unwanted publicity and embarrassment, tracking behaviors, everything you rent, everything you lease, they will know about. And public aggregated searches that they could do. Again, all that is something in their power. Number six, smart meters are undemocratic. Smart meters have been forced on millions of Americans without their consent. Requiring this technology to be used without first engaging in a democratic debate over its merits undermines political process. And finally, number seven, smart meters are costly. Despite claims to the contrary, the use of smart meter technology may actually be increasing utility bills. A recent survey of more than 400 people revealed a 35% increase in utility bills after installation of a smart meter. In addition, lawsuits have come about as a result of alleged overcharging by utility companies after installing these meters. So that's the bad news. What can you do about it? Even a brief examination of the evidence reveals that smart meter technology is dangerous, undemocratic, and offers little or no benefit for the average American. The organization known as Stop Smart Meters provides a lot of good tips. For example, for homeowners with an analog meter, do not allow smart meter installers on your property. Call police if they trespass. Form a neighborhood watch. Send a certified letter to your utility refusing consent to install. Secure an analog meter behind lock and key. Refuse to pay opt-out fees. Hundreds of thousands are refusing to pay fees to keep their analogs in California and elsewhere. And while PG&E in California has threatened disconnects, they have yet to carry out this threat simply for refusing to pay an opt-out fee currently in dispute. For homeowners with smart meters, revoke consent via certified letter to the utility and set a deadline for removal of existing smart meter. Demand that the meter be removed. Do not take no for an answer. It is your home and your authority, not theirs. Assume everything the utility says is self-serving. Do not trust them. Do not be fooled by a digital radio-off meter or an analog meter with transmitting equipment in it. Ask them to confirm in writing that the meter is a non-electronic electromechanical analog meter. If utility continues to insist on their illegal trespass, people have had their smart meters removed by a qualified professional and replaced with purely electromechanical analog meters. So you can purchase a reliable analog online. Keep your distance, pets and plants, and from all transmitters. Find out about shielding devices as a last resort. And avoidance is best. Be aware that cell phones, cordless phones, Wi-Fi routers, microwaves, and baby monitors also emit carcinogenic radiation, and they should be curtailed or eliminated. The outcome of pending legislation in New York and several other states will play a key role in deciding the fate of smart meters in the coming years. Become educated, and then you can do something constructive. I'm Gary Nall. That's a special report on an important topic. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We have a lot more to share with you today. Welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Nall. On the road today, be back in the studio on Monday, but we have a lot to share. I believe that we have connected with our guest, Barry Lando, in Paris, France. Barry is a Canadian award-winning journalist who was the producer for 60 Minutes for 25 years, primarily producing the stories that Mike Wallace featured. He's won many awards, including two Emmys, a George Polk Award, and the Robert F. Kennedy Award for Journalism. He's a graduate of Harvard and Columbia Universities. He has produced very important stories, including being the first to interview the Ayatollah Khomeini after the Iran hostage crisis and the 1990 riots on the Temple Mount. He has also written articles for The Atlantic and Christian Science Monitor and Le Monde in France, International Tribune, and others. He's the author of Web of Deceit, about the history of Western complicity in the creation of the Iraq state. And his most recent book is the novel The Watchman's Files. And his website is barrymlando.com. That's L-E-N-D-O. Nice to have you with us today, Barry.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Thank you. Barry, we have several important topics I would appreciate if you explored with us. But I'd also like to begin with an article you wrote last month about what you called the perfect technological storm that is on the horizon and which will have enormous adverse impacts on work and employment in the future. As you noted, this is being called the second machine age and the fourth industrial revolution. You reference a Citibank and Oxford study that concluded that about 47% of American jobs could be lost due to the robotics and artificial intelligence, and it would be much worse in countries like China. So please take your time and share with us this tsunami in the making, because this is something the average citizen has no idea about. And increasingly, much of what we buy and assume has human hands being part of its manufacturing is actually humanless machines. The form is yours.
Yeah, well, it's, the one who's written a lot about this is Ray Kurzweil, who's a futurist, and he's written several books about it. What is, you say, it's not really something that's happening in the future. It's actually something that is we're in the middle of right now, and there's been a tremendous surge in robotics, in robots taking over manufacturing. Entire plants have been turned into robotic fields, in effect. And we know that, we see it, and we don't seem to connect that with a tremendous loss of jobs, which is already occurring throughout the United States and throughout the world. Actually, one of the countries that is doing most to manufacture robots themselves and to introduce them into their manufacturing is China, which we always thought of as a place that had, you know, kind of cheap labor. It had an advantage because of that. And yet they're really leading the world in replacing their cheap labor with robots, which you wonder why, because you would think that they need jobs for their people. You'd think they're going to be doing a lot of their people out of jobs. That's going to be a big political problem for them going forward, one would think. For instance, the plant that manufactures the iPhone, which is a huge, they have several huge plants in China, and over 100,000 workers in one, they're planning to change 100,000 workers to, by 75% of those workers are going to be robots within the next 3 years. That's in China. And there's a new Adidas plant that's being built in Germany. And Germany, there's all kinds of celebration while we're getting basic manufacturing coming back to Germany. But the Adidas plant is basically going to be all robots. They're probably robots made in Germany, but they're going to be robots, not human beings. And this is something, as you look around you, you see it everywhere. The driverless cars that are already being developed, they're already being tested on highways in California. Think what happens when you have not only driverless cars, but driverless trucks. And how many hundreds of thousands of jobs are going to go down the drain once that happens. And we're talking now not decades away. We're talking about, in some cases, just a few years away. Even airline pilots, you would think you're not going to have robots flying planes, but already with automatic pilots, estimates are that the average pilot on a big-time jet only really flies it for about 7 or 8 minutes during a trip. The rest of the time, it's the robots are taking over, and even including taking off and landing. So this is what's going on, and it's what I found remarkable, really, because I'm not the first one, obviously, to write about this, but what I found remarkable about it is that no one is really talking about it in political terms. In other words, the political debates that are going on in the United States today, Trump and Clinton and so on, or in Europe, in Germany and France and England, you hear hardly anything at all about robots stealing jobs. You hear a lot about foreign immigrants. You hear a lot about building walls against the Mexicans. You hear a lot about that kind of thing, but you don't have anybody saying, hey, just a second, what are we going to do about this process that's already going on, robots? How are we going to deal with it? And in fact, there are some people who are saying that not too far down the line in human terms, I mean, we're talking about 30 or 40 years, the majority of the jobs that exist today and the majority of jobs that will exist tomorrow are going to be handled by robots and artificial intelligence. And we're going to come to a defining point at which point we really don't have much of a role anymore to play, human beings. This is not science fiction any longer. This is very serious writers who are talking about it. I mean, robots have already beat human beings in chess. That's been done years ago. But soon they're going to be beating us in everything. And then what do we do? And again, this is not like science fiction pie in the sky. This is something that is going on right now.
Barry, I'd like to take this a little further in this respect. When you just mentioned where does that leave us, I believe that we have to redefine us, and for a couple of reasons, and I'll give some statistics here to back this up. There is a new report that shows that as of today, we have 102 million working-age Americans who do not have jobs. And this is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they added 38,000 jobs in May. And that's way below what they expected. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics also claims that the number of Americans, quote, not in the labor force increased by 664,000 in 1 month from April to May. That made no headlines in any media in the United States. So they say, oh, there were 37,000 jobs, 38,000 jobs that were taken. No one said 664,000 Americans in 1 month simply dropped out. So the labor force participation rate now is down to 62.6%, and that's a 38-year low. So when you add the number of working-age Americans that are officially unemployed, which is only 7.4 million, to the number of working-age Americans that are considered to be, quote, not in the labor force, which is 94.7 million, you get a grand total of 102 million Americans who could work but don't have a job. So it's amazing to me that the media, including your former network, does not come forward and do an expose. You say we're at 4.7% unemployment. Well, how's that possible? We're closer to 25% unemployment. Now, sure, that's one part of the problem, that we're not even honest about who's out of work. And the people who are out of work, who can't find work, who can only find part-time work, who can only find minimal wage work.
Well, and these people are
not policy makers.
These people are going to be
then
fine.
The other part of this, the perfect storm, is that for the last 8 years, there have been well over 2 million Americans who are upper middle class workers. They've generally been there 20 to 30 years. They have seniority. Their jobs are being taken by highly qualified individuals who are willing to work for one half to one third of what we're paying that American with no benefits. And so law firms are then going out and making seminars all over countries like South Korea and India in China and getting the best and brightest to come in with PhDs frequently and replacing an American. We don't have a word about that said anywhere. I haven't seen demonstrations, discussion. What do you do when you build up a standard of living, when you've contributed to your society and to the workplace, and now you have a person coming in, and we can't blame the person, they're just a person wanting to have a job, but they're willing to work for nothing. Well, there goes the unions, there goes representation, there goes fair bargaining. Now you've got people competing with Americans, and we're unprepared for that. But the third stage is, at the same time that Clinton and all other presidents, including Obama and George Bush and Ronald Reagan, they've been outsourcing jobs. The corporate takeovers through equity partnerships and hedge funds have downsized the American workforce substantially. Now, there's no accurate numbers. There's no one place you can go say how many jobs have we lost. Well, we lost 58,000 factories from 2000 to 2012 closed. Well, 58,000 factories, how many people worked in those factories? No one's counting. So it's millions of jobs lost over the last 30 years. So you take those three factors. Now, none of those are in discussion, with the exception of, well, I'll make jobs come back, but with no way of doing it. So vague promises. Now you add in artificial intelligence and robotics. So then, how are these people supposed to live? How are they supposed to feed their family? You've got 18 million hungry children right now in the United States. You've got 1.5 million homeless children going to school. You've got 48.4 million Americans on food stamps. You've got 15 million senior citizens that are so deprived financially that they couldn't go 1 week without having an income flow, or they couldn't pay for their lifestyle. Bring in robotics into that equation, and I'm seeing a really bad scenario.
No, I agree with all your points. I don't know the specific statistics, but I think probably some of those jobs, not some of them, but probably millions of the jobs that you're already citing, are never going to come back, and they have been taken over by robots, by artificial intelligence. I mean, we're talking about private investment advisors now. Banks are, instead of hiring human beings to be private investment advisors to their clients, they're using artificial intelligence. They're using algorithms that give much more accurate information to their customer than some guy out of college. And guy went to college to learn how to do that. But they're already being replaced, believe it or not. And when one of the big fears is if they do succeed in raising the minimum wage in the United States, and the minimum wage is very low in most places, a lot of the people running those companies, say McDonald's and other fast food places, are already making the calculation, well, gee, if it goes up another $3 or another $4, it's going to be cheaper to bring in robots to serve. I mean, I watched here in, I don't know if it's true in the United States too, but in the Nespresso stores, you know, those very fancy Nespresso boutique stores selling coffee, they've all been automated. So you go into them now and there's hardly any personnel there. There's just a scanner that you run the coffee you've chosen over, and it tells you how much you owe, and then you walk out. And there's no reason this can't be done at stores all over the world, and it is. And as a matter of fact, the BBC posted a very interesting interactive site, which I referred to in my article, which you look down at it and you look at the job that you've got, and it tells you how likely such jobs are to be snuffed out, be eliminated in the next few years. In other words, bank loan officers, 98% likely to be eliminated. Paralegals and legal aides, you're talking about lawyers, 94% of them likely to be eliminated. Retail salespeople, 92%. Taxi drivers and chauffeurs, 89%. Also high on the list, fast food cooks and bartenders, 77%. Security guards, 75%. I mean, it's a really impressive, very scary list. And as you said, as I said, you don't hear it being talked about at all, not in the debates. I mean, we're talking about building walls to keep out the Mexicans. We're talking about bad trade treaties that we signed up to, and there's truth to all that. But that's not the problem. Over to you.
What are we going to do with these people? Barry?
Yes.
How do we help these people?
Well, you don't. That's the big question. I mean, I think you get down to a declining, if these futurists are right, and, you know, I'm not an expert, I'm not a scientist, but if they're right, and innovation is coming on now at what they call now quantum speed. In other words, there's a very fascinating kind of graph that talks about innovation and industrial progress in the world. And, you know, since about the Industrial Revolution in the 16th, 17th century, the line kind of goes along and starts rises a little bit each year. But then around 1990, the graph just takes a sharp curve and starts going vertically up. So that this century, we're going to do, you know, 1,000 times more progress in this one century than we did in the rest of human history, according to these futurists. And when you look at the articles that you come out every day now in the various science magazines and the popular magazines, they're all talking about this new stuff that's going on, these new fancy things you can do with your iPhone, how Siri on your iPhone can not only talk to you, it will soon be suggesting, and it does, and suggest things you ought to do. And then it, you know, make appointments for you, even though you haven't really asked it to make appointments yet. And this is just the beginning. So I don't know what you do. I mean, I have three kids, and they're all in sort of in the area of science and high tech. But they're going to have to run faster and faster just to keep up to be able to do a job in this world, because. Even the question of people are saying, you know, higher education is the answer. Well, but higher education for what? These very fancy jobs, designing algorithms, designing cars, etc., those can also be taken over by robots. So then what do you do? And I don't know the answer, and that's my whole point. But one of the bottom line question, again, from the futurists is, human beings, we've kind of come to the end of a stage in human history, or maybe in our species history, and we are about to be replaced by something we've created, which is robots, artificial intelligence, that is going to replace us. In many cases, it already is. And at a certain point, which is not, we're talking only a few years away, you come to what Ray Kurzweil calls the singularity, when robots really do take over. This is within the next 20 or 30 years. Because they're more intelligent, they'll be more mobile, far faster than us. So what, not only what do we do, but what good are we really at that point?
You've raised some very important and critical questions that the mainstream media needs to discuss in earnest. Because with all these people out of work now, and getting worse, and robotics challenging more people, including those who had been gainfully employed and a living wage, they're going to be losing work. And we know we outsourced 3.5 million jobs already to China between 2001 and 2014. I believe that's conservative. So just imagine a society of haves who benefit from the robotics and have-nots who now have to be in some way supported or subsidized. I see a lot of chaos coming.
Oh, it's already there. What's interesting, I mentioned in the article I wrote that a few months ago, a New York Times reporter was tagging along as Obama toured a sprawling new plant in Jacksonville, Florida, which is manufacturing lithium-ion batteries, which is kind of, you know, the edge in batteries these days. It was built with the help of U.S. government fund, which is designed to help that kind of cutting-edge technologies. But the Times columnist, who was Andrew Ross Sorkin, tagging along, and he noticed that it had a very small parking lot, this plant did. And he found out that this giant plant, that if it had been built several decades ago, would have easily employed a few thousand people. But because of robots, which were the main manufacturers in this plant, it employs only 300 people. That's it. And this was a major, you know, a major event, supposedly, by Obama and U.S. technology, etc. And it probably is, except it's not going to employ more human workers.
Barry, my final question is this. When you look at China, which has had astronomical growth over the last 10 years, now being challenged, but still around 5 to 6% growth, one of the reasons they built these phantom cities, one of the reasons they put so much energy into infrastructure is because they were wanting to give a lot of their rest of population a wage. And also they displaced so many from the country and wanted to continue this, you know, better education, better jobs, better pay, buy more things, buy things from inside of a country. That's going to impact China. It's going to impact India. It's going to impact other countries, too. And once it gets going, robotics is not going to stay in one place. So what does that foretell might happen in these other countries that have a history of, you know, social upheaval and hard demonstrations, as well as in the United States? Or do you believe it's possible that by the time the average American becomes fully aware of the significance of what's happening, that it'll be too late to do anything about it? I'd like your thoughts on this, please.
Well, I don't know what you really can do about it. I mean, first of all, China, as I mentioned, China is although it's got cheap labor, it's in the front of introducing robots into its factories. Because they're finding, you know, that Vietnam and other countries turned out cheaper labor, so China's going to go for robots now, and it's going to leave hundreds of thousands, probably millions of Chinese looking for other jobs. Maybe they'll get them in infrastructure. But as far as Americans go, I think one of the ways that they've been hit with this robots and artificial technology, artificial intelligence, is the hollowing out of the middle class. Everyone's talking about that, how the huge gap that's come up now between the tremendously wealthy and what used to be the middle class, who are becoming poorer and poorer. Well, one of the reasons for that huge gap is because those jobs, what were formerly middle class jobs, have been or are being taken over with artificial intelligence and robotics. You know, all these jobs I was talking about, accountants, bank managers, tellers, a lot of people working in hospitals, etc., they can be replaced now by robots. And so that whole sector of the population is being hit, and they're going to be continued to hit more and more over the next few years. We're talking about the next really few years. And they already feel that. They already know that. They already know their jobs are threatened. This is not something new, and it's one of the reasons I think that, you know, Donald Trump can play to them, and other right-wing leaders, same is true in Europe, can play to that fear of losing your job, the fear that your child is not going to have as good a life as you do, but they're not citing one of the major causes, which is this tremendous progress that's going on in the world, technological progress. How do you deal with that? I think it means a total reorganization of society. It'll mean, in the end, it's almost the perfect communist system. In other words, to each according to his needs, so from each according to his means. And if society, a robotic society, essentially, robotic companies and robotic firms produce the goods and services that people need, people will have a right to those goods and services. It'll have to be the state in some way parceling, making sure you get those goods and services that are being produced. I mean, that's the ideal version. This all sounds kind of pie in the sky, except it's going on right now.
Well, we appreciate you bringing this to our attention and sharing this, and we thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
From Paris, France, Barry Landau, author of Web of Deceit and his newest book, The Watchman's Files. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.